Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
It is 8 minutes after 9 o'clock here on the West Coast. Joining me from McAllen, Texas is Tim Lynch. Timmy, what's up?
Not much, Mac. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. And from Southern California is Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how are you?
I'm good, Mac. How are you?
I'm well. And from someplace in the suburb of Kansas City, a guy whose property value has gone up 15% in the last few months. And that is Will Cosentini. So Will, how are you?
I'm good, Mac. Hey, besides the music, I'm getting another like feed into the Skype.
Hold on. One of you guys has to hang around and fix up, help me fix it because I'm feeding you guys something that I can't hear. So I've got to mess with some dials. So I need, and it seems to be a regular problem. So anyway, one of you will get a call from me to troubleshoot that. So. Hopefully,
that was a good song, though, that was on.
It was B.B. King with You Too. No, it's a great song. We're going to talk about China, and we're going to talk about this series of Marine Corps Gazette started called The Maneuverists. And because we were all a part of that discussion – But I'd like to talk about China first because it's much in the news based on a report that the DOD issued about China and where it is. So, Jeff, you want to go first?
Yeah.
Give us, we'll go around the horn kind of, give me a general thought about the article about China written by Todd South, who writes for Marine Corps Times. I think Todd's a former Marine himself, and this appeared in Military Times because of its broader appeal. But give us a thought on the article itself. General thought.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean, it's good. You know, it's like it's thoughtful. A lot of times I try and figure out what would be the shape of conflict in China. I always would try and figure out what would our next fight be like since I was, a sergeant, basically. So, I think it's good. I think, though, that most of our stuff is going to initially be defeat, kind of like World War II. You know, I mean...
In the first phases of it? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, yes. And I don't know if we have the resiliency now that we had... then I know we were during World War II, in the beginning of World War II, we were less prepared both materially and, and manpower wise to deal with it, but we knew it was coming kind of, and that was exacerbated by bad judgment calls, I think, on the part of the president, actually, in the Pacific, especially, but I think, that we would, in the beginning, yeah, we would suffer setbacks because we wouldn't, I don't think we're as ready psychologically now for a conflict like that as we were by the time it broke out in 1941.
Interesting. Let me make a comment on that and then see if Will and Tim want to. I think that's, by design. I think the Chinese would not choose to contest us. They would choose to slowly but surely – be the boa constrictor that just strangles everybody. So I think that's right. That's the game that they play. That is, standing up power projection in terms of amphibious forces and naval forces as they stand up their economy. And we don't want a conflict with the United States, but we do want to be. But power projection will be a part of that. And so I think that's the game that they play. Will, Tim, any comments about that?
I I got a comment, and that is before the war with Japan, I mean, Commodore Kulak's father was in China scouting out the Japanese because they knew that a conflict with them was inevitable. And so it wasn't like we were totally surprised. We were unprepared, but at least we had some semblance of a strategy of what we were going to do. I don't see anything remotely like that with China. We've got a plan that 10 years from now we'll be able to pace the pacing threat, but the pacing threat seems to be pacing us. And it
wait a minute. Don't you think General Berger's plan with the Marine Corps is an attempt to, you know, to be Pete Ellis and create, you know, think of amphibious operations and in the context of the South China Sea and America's primary adversary?
If you want to look at it like the Thucydides trap, which is exactly what the Japanese emerging empire was to America, that's what he's doing. And you can also say he's a realist because he knows the money's going to get turned off very soon, which may or may not happen. I don't know. But what I do know is we don't have the ass behind us that we had in World War II. And I'm not so sure how much of our critical logistics infrastructure is dependent on supply chains coming out of China. It damn sure is on the medical side of things. So we're in a precarious position of being paced by a country who has already articulated that every bit of the state power is war. Commerce is war. You know, the Belt and Road Initiative is war. But now they've got 350 ships. They're trying to be a blue water navy and power project, but they're not exactly an uncorrupt people, and they're going to have issues with that, right? And that's going to hamstring them for years to come. That's your breathing space. But the thing is they're acting aggressive. You know, this Wuhan virus erupts, and instead of acting in any way repentant, they're seizing terrain. They're warring. They're killing Indian soldiers with clubs. They are aggressively expanding their hold in all dimensions. And you're running into significant problems with host nations up in the stands, in particular, with that Belt and Road Initiative. Because the Kazakhstans and all those other stands, they're not interested in fighting the guerrillas to keep China's supply lanes open. And that was a big gamble on their part. So they're facing friction on every place they're expanding from local peoples. And so going after them with a coalition is the only realistic alternative we have, because we don't have the capability of cranking out a couple hundred ships in a year like we used to. This is not going to happen.
Right.
We couldn't crew them.
Right. Will?
Yeah. I think it's really hard for me to see a kinetic war between the U.S. and China. It doesn't seem to be the way they're trying to play now. And I think sort of the scenarios that were laid out in that Military Times article in particular, you know, I think the war it can be won or lost before the first shot. You know, it's a cyberspace war up front. And I was never in that part of the world, but I think we're more vulnerable than anyone ever really wants to think about, or we may be stronger there. Don't know. But a kinetic war is just really hard for me to see between us and them. And even some of the scenarios in that article about big time kinetic war, you know, the guy's talking about Iwo Jima-like situation in Taiwan. So what does China get if they destroy Taiwan? I'm not sure I understand. I think the boa constrictor thing is much more understandable and insidious. The problem is, do they have enough time, right? Because somewhere 20 to 30 years from now, China has the worst demographics of any other place on Earth.
Right.
Explain that. Explain that to everybody. Listen.
So they went to the one child, and then so they cut off, you know, two generations of young people, and then they did sex-selected abortions. So they're very imbalanced. And I don't know what the numbers are, but it's like 60-40 men to women or something like that. And so they are aging rapidly. And while they have a huge workforce to employ now, in 30 years, that means they've got a huge old age population and nowhere near the workforce to replace it. And the other thing interesting about that is we'll know in about 10 years they loosened up the one child. But I think the initial returns when they said people could have more than one child is that people didn't want to do it because they had gotten used to having one kid and really investing in that one kid, and they couldn't afford to have two kids. And so then if you've got, you know, 90% of your population only has one child, how willing are you to risk a major kinetic war? You know, just as families, that I think can lead to certain civil unrest and internal instability. So I don't know that they have enough time to complete the strategy of the boa constrictor, or maybe that they have limited objectives in this. I don't know. It's a really interesting problem, and I'm a little bit wary of, I'm a little bit wary of the, we've got to spend on our military crowd. We need capability, but we need balanced capability across the spectrum. Because we could bankrupt ourselves worse than we're doing now. If we don't fully understand what they think they're at and what we're trying to achieve, just building because, well, they've got 300 ships. I don't buy that. I don't think that's a great investment. So we should think through that because it is the challenge of our current, at least next half generation, 10, 15 years.
Boys, any comment on what Will said?
Yeah, I do. I think all the stuff Will said about the demographics is pretty compelling and shows pressure that China is putting on itself. But I think this about war with China also. You know, in our history, I can only think of, besides some of the Native American conflicts, there's only one that leaps out at you as being a deliberate, premeditated assault upon other sovereign nations, and that's Germany and Japan during the Second World War. On the other hand, most of the other ones are pretty much the result of miscalculation. In other words, a gamble that was where the person gambled wrong. Right. And for instance, the Korean War, you know, that's the closest kinetic thing we got to the type of individuals who are running the communist states. And that was a total miscalculation. They thought they had, according to the Venona tapes, those things that were uncovered when after the Soviet Union fell, Mao had approached, along with Kim Il-sung, had approached Stalin for permission because they were pretty much even though they later fell out, you know, China and the Soviet Union, they're pretty much in each other's closely related. He said, hey, we want to attack in 1948. No, can't do that. You know, the Americans, they'll probably drop the A-bomb on us and we can't do it. Then again in 49, and they said, no, we can't, you know. But then in late 49, early 50, I can't remember his name, one of the super intelligent guys from Harvard that were working for President Truman, he was working, it might have been Dean Rusk, said, you know, here's the line of influence, and the line did not include in the Pacific, did not include the Korea at all, not even South Korea. And based on that and some other speeches that were made about not going to war and so forth, and about, you know, basically disparaging the services on the part of President Truman, they went ahead and invaded South Korea. And that was a miscalculation, and they took the brunt of the punishment for that. So I think if we do have a war, I don't think it would be in anyone's, I agree with all you guys saying that you think they're going to push, they're going to try the, you know, the engulf and devour thing, you know, the Python type deal. I agree with all that.
Boa constrictor, get your snakes right.
Okay, sorry. But you know, that's what I think. I think if it happens, it'll be the result of, you know, of a miscalculation, grabbing of an island they thought we weren't going to contest, and we wouldn't probably contest, but our leaders are subject to the whim of the media and so forth, although the media is behind pretty much one branch of our political party system. But, they could miscalculate what we would put up with. Right. And possibly that would be Taiwan, you know.
What did you find in this article most interesting? And the article's about, 12 or 13 pages when you print it out? I think it's like 13-page article. It's not – you're not going to – you know, it's fairly weighty and lengthy article talking about both the, Chinese designs in terms of the South China Sea, Chinese designs relative to the East China Sea and the Senkaku Islands. What did you, Timmy? Start with you. What did you find most interesting, what did you personally find interesting? Maybe something that you didn't know, or an angle you thought was interesting in the article.
Well, when they start talking about going into Taiwan and forcing us into an Iwo Jima type of assault, that certainly got my attention. I just find that hard. It's something they can't do accidentally. I mean, they got to mass and do a lot of preparation in order to grab Taiwan, and I just find that hard to see happening. But it's an interesting possibility. I'm not so sure about I know they have the capability with these missiles to kill ships in this and put up this area denial system. But we don't know that they can exercise that capability. I'm very doubtful that they will do that. And I think that we would aggressively at first go after them. I just don't see us tripping that tripwire, and I don't see them doing it either. Because the results, if it escalates quickly, they sink a carrier, and then it's over. Because then we're going to demand to get our piece of ass for that, and we'll go on an American crusade. And they don't want that; they can't compete with that. And so I just find the whole discussion interesting and alarming, given the fact that we're kind of changing away from what we could contribute to that fight. Which just it deepens my suspicions about the current changes in the force structure.
Well, something from the article that broke squelch for you that you found interesting.
Yeah, when the Air Force Chief of Staff, C.Q. Brown, says that we've got to be prepared for World War II level attrition, I mean, he's out of his mind. World War II level attrition, how many thousands of aircraft did we lose in World War II? We lost thousands of aircraft in training accidents. We built a Navy of well over 1,000 ships. World War II level attrition? Maybe he's trying to make a rhetorical point, but that's not helpful when a service chief comes out.
I got a data. An estimated total number of destroyed and damaged aircraft in the war was 76,875, of which 40,000 were total losses.
Yeah. World War II level attrition. So that,
I'll give you ships right now. 1,554 ships were sunk.
We lost five of the current U.S. navies, five of them, in World War II. And we how many airplanes could there be in the Air Force right now?
Hold on. That might not be. That was like all merchant. That includes merchant shipping, too.
All right.
Let me get you a better number, but keep going. Keep going.
Yeah, so it just if that's part of our information campaign – to prepare the public, the problem when you make a point when you say something like that, it destroys your arguments because it's not a credible point.
So that
bothers me when I say
that. Prepared for World War II level attrition. I mean, when you think about Range 410 Alpha or Range 400. basically it's like an Iwo Jima problem, you know? And the idea is to put out enough steel to suppress the enemy to deal with it. So the Air Force guy means it as this is prohibitive, where, you know, and,
I think Will's right in that he's trying to make a larger point, in terms of if we think we're going to do boutique war onesies and twosies when you go fucking around with the Chinese, if that's what you think, you might want to come off that.
Yeah, I'm starting to think, though, that when these generals say stuff, they're not even talking to us. They're only talking to people who will vote on their next promotion or, you know, their next job.
Sounds like a little bit cynical for this early in the morning on the West Coast. Let me tell you what I thought was interesting. I thought the part about the Marine Corps was kind of interesting because they talk about skirmishers, right? Skirmishers are important. This Marine Corps running around and talking about, you know, war in the gray zone. And then there's a section called Tell It to the Marines, and they quote Dakota Wood. He's a retired lieutenant colonel, and he works at the Heritage Foundation. He says this, skirmishers, when employed effectively, can have a significant impact. Talks about the Marine Corps running around with its anti-ship missiles, anti-air missiles, and even a limited cyber capability. Then it says this, however, to avoid counterattacks from the Chinese forces, Marines would have to move from island to island every few days or every few hours. Signature management really does matter. You have to make it Hold on. Before, you have to make it hard as possible for the enemy to figure out where you're at and what you're doing. Now, and then it goes on. If Marines were able to create and defend forward refueling and rearming bases, it could massively extend the time a Navy ship could stay in the fight. Right? Right? Beyond the equipment concerns, the biggest issue preventing Marines from fully committing to a dispersed fight against China is the lack of basing agreements between the U.S. and nations that play a key role in the fight. And then this is from a guy named Doherty. Quote, it's really hard to win a Taiwan fight without access to the Philippines. I don't see that reflected in the priorities of our national security community. So I thought that was really interesting. A couple things. Like, we talk about this. You know, one of the things I like about these articles is that we've kind of beat up most of the points these very high-end experts make. And that makes me happy, right? The Mensa sisters, okay, and myself, right? When we beat this stuff up, I read that, I'm like, been there, done that. All right, tell me something I don't know. But
I have to interrupt you, man.
Oh, no, I'm not going to allow it. Hold on. Let me just make
– otherwise. Then
No. Don't play – hey, I talked to three of our friends who said, you and that bullshit, I got blown up, and this is what affects my brain. They all said, Kenny is such a fucking liar about that shit. He's been doing that shit forever. So anyway, two things. The names will be omitted from this. The skirmisher thing, without basing agreements, about ability to move inland in the Philippines, very, very problematic, okay? Which the whole thing rests upon. Next thing is the Philippines. The pivotal role the Philippines plays in all of this. They sit smack dab in the middle of, you know, of the confrontation in the South China Sea. And as the Philippine goes, maybe that conflict goes. They make it much easier if they are on board with the free nations of the world. And conversely, on the southern flank of Taiwan, they make that fight a much, much different fight. So I thought those were two interesting. The fundamental premise on which the Marine Corps bases its thing is that we're going to get these ships in there. And then we talked about this. The Chinese militia, they're not going to be all over that like a hobo on a ham sandwich. Probably. Okay, that's problematic, right? Because you're not going to have the freedom of movement because you're going to have these fucking fishing boats always following you. Jeez, how do they find us all the time? Jeez, why can't we ever get away from them? God, they must have great engines inside those little sampans. And then the key role of the fucking Philippines. So Jeffrey,
you're missing the implied task.
Hold on, hold on. Jeffrey's got a point that if we don't get to his damaged brain, he'll forget it.
The whole Philippines and Taiwan thing, I mean, like you say, there's a lot of hardware missing that gets us to those places that we had in World War II and we just don't have now. We got the old burning BHR there, which I looked at from across the bay there in Coronado, we don't have the ass to be able to do some of that stuff anymore by a long shot, you know.
And that's the implied task.
Yeah.
See what you've got to do is you've got these Marines are bouncing from island to island. And the implied task, if their job is to rearm and refit ships, which I've never heard of, but okay, they're going to rearm and refit ships. Well, they've got to seize the population and enslave them and seize the infrastructure. So they grab all the Chinese, round them up, and make them load the ships up. That must be the implied task, because I don't see how else you do it.
Yeah, that's a hell of a
thing. How the hell are you going to load a ship with what? Good God, man. That's a goofy article. I mean, that's just a weird point.
The thing that gets me about this, you know, Marine Corps strategy and skirmishers is the risk profile. You know, we've been fighting a war for 20 years. I was only there twice. I don't see the appetite for risk. And then the logistics side of this, you know, at some point you got to eat and drink. I don't know how you move the force size, and I don't know what that force size is, but if you want to be able to shoot missiles, have cyber, operate drones, you know, it's not a recon team. So you got to get that in. You've got to hide the signature, and you've got to support them logistically.
Amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics. I think Soupy Sales said that.
Wait a minute. Will was coming close to that, though. He was groping his way to a conclusion. What's your conclusion, Will? What are you trying to say?
Yeah, I don't understand how you take 180,000 man force and how you bring that to bear the way they're talking about. And I think on the map, people have a very high risk tolerance. And in the real world, I just didn't see that. We didn't typically have platoon size units all alone and unafraid. We thought they were a long ways away. When they were 50 miles away from a company commander with a satellite, link and underneath the Golden Hour umbrella. And that was really stretching it. The idea that you're going to have people outside the umbrella, and I'm not sure what a platoon actually does. So now you're going to put companies out there or something like that.
Well, let me throw this out there. The idea of the Golden Hour is a thing of the past. That was a convenience of a permissive environment that will not exist in peer-to-peer conflict.
Okay, and I don't disagree with that, but it's not clear when you're putting skirmishers into little islands that you're in a true peer-to-peer conflict. Because if we go peer-to-peer with the Chinese, cyber, nuclear, right? The only reason we're going to be fighting them mano-a-mano is because we think our national essence is at stake. And the idea that we're going to be able to have this brush fire, low-level skirmishers war between us and them, heads up, and keep it at that, and it'll just stay at that low burn forever, we don't have to worry about it, I think is wacko. We're fighting a gray sort of war when we get into the skirmishers. And, you know, is the commandant going to tell people straight up, hey, there ain't no Golden Hour, get over it? Okay.
Yeah. I just don't see that. Right after 9/11, they're talking about putting the Green Beret into Afghanistan. And Shelton, the Army Chief of Staff, he's like, hey, we can't do that. There's no Golden Hour. I mean, are you kidding me? You guys are supposed to be snake eaters and stuff. I mean, that's part of the impetus to send General Mattis and the two Mews in there. And you know,
and look, I don't know senior if leaders
have the intestinal fortitude to face that type of approbation from the public. You
yeah,
know?
Senior leaders in our generation couldn't get the idea that on Major Fobs you actually don't need a coffee shop, line dancing, and a burger.
Right.
Right. So the idea that they're willing to risk people and put them out there in hard places for long times, and know that if it gets a little kinetic with them, that people are just going to die. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I remember in the 5 weeks of bad weather you have in Iraq, you know, December, January, early February type shit, if the weather was too bad for the air to fly, they wouldn't let you, like, you get stuck on, like, I remember going to Haditha from Al Asad, stuck there because they wouldn't let us leave, you know, the damn fob there because of they thought that if we got hit, there'd be no way to medevac us. But the truth is, the enemy were weather pussies, so it's actually a better time to go. But you know but I remember that, and that was General Neller. I'll say it right here. You know, hey, you know, he's already thinking like he got beat, and that is not the exception. That's the rule with our senior leaders now, I think.
Well, the other thing is it's describing pseudo-ops. The only military to ever successfully do that was Rhodesia with their Stellar Scouts, where you had white officers and black troops that go into the neighboring countries and stay there for months at a time. And those pseudo-operators, they would tear people up because they'd surprise them. But you can't do that indefinitely, for one thing. We don't have the resources that Rhodesians have, i.e. the ability to have white officers that spoke native language, that level of detail. You can do it, but that's what it takes. That's what they're describing is a pseudo operation. Otherwise, what they're describing is just bizarreness, because how the hell are you going to hide uniformed Marines anywhere? Even on an abandoned island, they're going to stick out, you know, to overhead imagery, which you can buy commercially on a 24-hour feed.
Well, let me just tell you this. I think that if you had treaties with nations in the region where you could go ashore, right, and you could go, I'll use an aviation term, nose cold, right, and you could move, if you're land based at that point, right, you can, that's much more formidable, and much more survivable, right? But we don't have this ship thing. The ship becomes an albatross because the ship is trackable. The ship's easy. The Chinese, right, be all over that ship, right? And so I think that's problematic. And I don't see, as Timmy has talked about, and I've had people approach me, you know, you just don't understand it. I think I do. But you're fairy dusting this shit, and if I take away your fairy dust and say, no, you've really got to do it, then what? As Will said, that's on top of the appetite for risk. You're going to look at people and say, yeah, we've got 20 boats, and we're going to stick them out there, and they may not come back.
Yeah, it's like almost like a combination of like a super, you know, technical Anglico, like you know, team mixed in with a Coast Watcher type thing where they can do this type of stuff, but it certainly isn't your average.
Except you don't have permission to go.
That's huge, right? We haven't. I mean, that's the first thing.
Non-permissive.
And also the idea of countries that might be friendly to us. There's no word at all from anybody in the federal government, particularly the State Department, or the NSC about approaching other countries with permissions and stuff, which is going to be a big.
Which is stupid, right? And to me, it's the biggest thing that I think the president has screwed up and the State Department, Mike Pompeo, has screwed up is that, look, if this is important, right, then we've got to find a way to get the Philippines, Vietnam, you know, Malaysia, go down the list. Those have to be welded to us. And I thought it was awesome that you see the Secretary of Defense in Palau this week. The Chinese are courting them. They want to give them. They want to do Belt and Road with them. And so, to me, if we don't create a subsequent version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership with the specific intent of we got to weld these son of a bitches to us, because that's the deterrent to the Chinese.
Yeah,
is that we're going to be ashore in Vietnam. We're going to be ashore in the Philippines. We're going to be dug in, and they're fucking screwed. The juice ain't with the sweet.
Right. You're right, Matt.
Thank you.
You're right.
I love what
you said. One possibility is it's the president and Pompeo screw up about this. The other possibility is it's General Berger screw up because he's the only one really talking about this stuff, and he's over his skis.
Oh. Maybe.
Because
you know?
We're not hearing it from anybody else except people denying they're going to give us tanks and the Navy saying we're not going to build all these extra ships and all this stuff. Yeah. You know?
Well, so it does. There seems to be a disconnect from what General Berger is doing, right? And you talk about over your skis. To me, he's on a limb and he's sawing it off, and we don't have ships. We don't have funding, right? And to me, all the connecting rods aren't there. And yet the Marine Corps is all in. And so where does that leave you? Tankless light outfit that can't get there because the ships you want aren't there. The ships you need are burning in port. It's not a pretty picture.
We ought to be throwing the big, huge American money seduction rug at Vietnam.
Oh, my God.
And partnering up with them more. That would be some distributed ops. What if you start farming out little fire support teams on Vietnamese pirate ships?
Let me tell you, to me, I think foreign policy job number one is the Philippines. And so let me ask you this: we've had this construct post World War II is that the United States foots the bill for the defense of the world, and everybody else kind of fakes it a little bit, you know. The Chinese have a design for the planet, and that is they will dominate it economically. They will dominate it militarily. And if our allies don't realize that they've got to at least be able to be a mediocre defensive organization that can plug into the Americans, right, so that we can have this global deterrence, I don't know that – I think it's simply a question of time till the Chinese achieve their end.
Yeah.
I hate to be that guy, but I am.
No, I mean,
Vietnam hates him. Go ahead, Will.
Yeah, I mean, the Roosevelt, didn't they do a port visit in Hanoi?
They did.
Yeah, I mean, so the idea that we're not courting Vietnam, we are for sure.
I don't mean militarily. I mean economically. That we are the robust power. We and our partners, the free nations of the world, have economies four times the size of China. And so,
I think those countries, and I won't ever give the State Department an A. Particularly, I won't even give them an A for effort. But I think economically, there's a lot of activity between us and Vietnam, and Vietnam has got a tiny little economy,
right.
But I think that there's been a huge rapprochement, and the idea that we're sending an aircraft carrier to Hanoi, big deal. It's hard sometimes to see inside everything, and I think the Philippines got a wacko on the top as much as anything. It's hard to gauge what is Filipino public opinion in regards to China and the U.S. But how many countries in the world, their population looks to China and to the Chinese and says, those are really good guys, right? They do it under duress at best.
Right.
So I think that there's opportunity and there's significant residual goodwill for the United States. Take away an educated upper crust from a certain number of those places because those kids all went to college.
I'm not used to you being this optimistic.
I don't know that I'm optimistic because I wouldn't want that.
Oh, I think you are.
That would be challenging. I think, though, where my argument comes from is I'm not sure sometimes where the military leadership is going. Again, when C.Q. Brown says World War II level attrition, when General Berger fundamentally reorients, I don't again, maybe I'm the idiot. I just don't see a kinetic war with China because we can't go there.
Well, what about
that? We simply don't have the resources.
Okay, we can't go there. We can't go there. So Jeff's argument is when people see asymmetry, they see opportunity. So you say we can't go there. Do the Chinese see an opportunity?
Again, and I said we can't go there kinetic. I don't think that they see an opportunity to go kinetic. That's why I think they're doing all these other things. And so I think our investment should be in other places, and our orientation should be in other places. Did you ever read Ghost Fleet?
No, I didn't. Jeff did.
It's been out a couple years. I mean, it's a novel, but it sort of describes this guy's view of the Chinese-U.S. conflict in 2035 or something. But the opening chapter, it's all space and cyber. And I don't – I mean, that seems obvious to me that if you can't dominate space or you can't use space, then we can't do any – you know, we can't communicate. We can't see. We can't do anything like that. And then cyber, the idea that – you know, we are so used to just picking up our phone or doing whatever we want to do and being in a denied environment that way, and it shuts down the economy. So I think that is the risky part. And then
what do you guys think the possibility is of a conflict starting over some kind of miscalculation like the Pueblo in 1969 or 68 and the some of these things that happened with the Iranians in the Gulf?
I have an answer for that. I don't see that. If we could coexist with the Russians for what, 60 years almost, 50 something years, I think that we can manage that with China because I think there's on both sides there's too much to lose. So to me the danger with the Russians was always their economy was small and so their military was big, and that asymmetry caused them to feel inferior. And that, to me, was the danger. The Chinese, you know, have great confidence in their economy. I mean, they see it. And so, to me, the longer problem is what Will talked about, is as China goes forward and changes, will they sense maybe their own vulnerability? But as long as they have such a robust economy and some ships are rising in China and their national prestige is rising, to me they have too much to lose to allow that to occur. And so we'll play chicken, you know, we'll sideswipe each other and do stupid shit. But, you know, what China wants is the boa constrictor model, which is somehow or other Taiwan to say, we'd love you to come home, even though we're never part of you guys before, but whatever. We'd love for you to show up. And so that's why I see the investment in our allies and in those relationships is the key to the whole deterrence piece. It's the free nations of the world ensuring that as we go forward, there is rules-based order, and China has to play by those rules. And if we won't do that, if we won't hang together, we shall all surely hang separately.
Yeah, I would say regarding miscalculation, you know, that may not be the most likely thing that happens, but it actually could be the most dangerous thing. So I think that Jeff's argument is compelling there in that case. And if we recognize that as being potentially the most dangerous, then that's what people in PACOM and the NSC and others should be really focused on when first reports come in. Is this the miscalculation? And have we war game that? you know, don't war game how we're going to retake Taiwan.
Iwo Jima style. Iwo Jima style.
Yeah, with 15 Chinese divisions dug in on it. So, yeah.
How do they get, you know, that's a bit of fairy dust too. How do you get 15 divisions onto Taiwan and they're dug in? How did that happen?
They use those jetpacks.
Like the one by LAX the other day.
It looks like the monkeys in Wizard of Oz coming across.
Timmy, you were trying to say something.
No, all I was going to say is in every place where China touches another country, it's got friction, with the exception of its 35-mile-long Afghanistan border. And that friction is causing them serious problems, to include India and Australia concluding a very close mutual agreement pact. And so our allies in the system, the one problem China has as they expand is they're assholes, and they don't treat the local people very well. And that's very apparent. And so I think that they've got the – now that they're expanding onto the world stage as a blue water navy, they've got to go through the growing pains and the friction of doing that efficiently, because I don't know what their corruption overhead is, but it's not zero. You know,
yeah,
I mean?
And in regards to that, I would say when those local places, if they're expanding into the stands or in Africa, when they start taking Chinese yuan in payment, then we know we've got a problem, right? Yeah. People don't want their money. People want our money.
Yep.
Yep. And so when they start taking their money, that's an indicator to us that people are actually accepting them, as opposed to just being mercenaries.
Yeah, but I honestly, to me, the reason the money flows to the United States is we're the most secure. Your money's
exactly.
Safe here, right? It's a laws-based nation. It's got two big oceans, so it's really hard to fuck with. And it's got an economy that, in spite of the size of China and India, still dwarfs both of them. And so dwarfs, but still is more robust. And so – and so to me, but and as long as we tend to that, and that's why our allies and I lament the stupidity of our allies, that they don't see this and they don't say, you know, we do. And Germany is number one on my list of village idiots. The enabler of Russia, the enabler of instability on the continent, Germany. Right, get your head out of your ass and join the free nations of the world. You know, the rest of us are over World War II. You need to be too, and come to the table and help stabilize the world and help it continue to be rules based order.
Yeah, but Mac, Trump is an idiot and a crazy man because he pointed that out, that they need to pay their fair share. The consensus in the Beltway is, yeah, we don't really mean it when we say we want them to pay. And only an idiot would say we want them to pay their fair share.
Well, let me tell you, right? If we don't require that and we don't have capable allies to plug into, then we will all surely hang separately.
No shit. Again, this crazy man from Manhattan overturns the accepted foreign policy establishment in D.C. and gets excoriated by all of them. When he's the only one in regard to this issue that's speaking what is like common sense.
In regards to most issues.
Well, relative to,
like all these government agencies, it's like you got a good guy over an organization of shitbirds. I mean, the State Department. I mean, when you're a 19-year-old Jeff Kenney and you can see what you got running the embassy in Iran, I mean, I'm like, these guys don't know what they're fucking doing. And they're talking to other people who don't know what they're doing, you know, the foreign ministry people in Iran, and the same thing in Germany when I went out there. And then whenever I'd have to come and rescue some of these, you know, as a Marine in either Lima 3-8 or Gulf 2-2, same shit. It's a bunch of shitbirds who believe in a one world order thing. They're not really very patriotic, you know, and they got this idea that they know better and that they got to protect the unwashed masses of the American citizenry from themselves. And I don't care about the Justice Department.
Yeah, it's not just the State Department. It's every Washington, D.C. institution.
Even the VA. You should have seen the shit I'm going through at the VA here the last couple of days. The same type of attitude. You don't know shit. I don't care what you went through. I don't care what you're telling me. You know, there's an arrogance that it's ingrained that, you know, we're from the government. And we're here to help ourselves, of course, not you.
All right. Do we want to talk about maneuver warfare here for a few minutes? First of all, the whole concept of just to put an end on that, I mean, you know, the president doesn't play the emperor's new clothes. I think that has all been refreshing for a lot of people. And Grant Newsham has a phrase where he says, you know, in the Pacific, the United States is finally standing up on its hind legs for once. And I think that's pretty look, we're not asking you to do anything crazy, but we need viable partners out here, or we will all surely hang or you will all surely hang separately. We'll be okay. We had two big oceans. We'll be fine, right? You will be screwed. So it's in your own self-interest. So let's talk about the maneuvers thing. Kind of interesting little concept to write about maneuver warfare, something that we were in Quantico, seeing it kind of develop. Jeff, how about a thought from the second article?
Well, now I'm going to really sound like a disgruntled guy, okay? But I think, and on reflection, when we were going through that phase, you know, I'd say late 80s to mid 90s or so, you know, for me, I mean, obviously it started before that with General Gray of the 2nd Marine Division. I thought the whole thing, looking back on it, is just kind of silly. You know, none of that stuff they're talking about the Germans. I really got interested in the Germans during this. I started really reading. And here's what I come away with the Germans and their wonderful operational design and slick way of doing business. They had a maniac in charge of them who would brook no dissent. And they were told, you got to do these impossible things with a dwindling, you know, supply chain, in the middle of the Soviet Union. And there's no arguing with the guy. So they figured out smart ways of trying to hang on. I mean, and to a lesser extent, they did that in World War One, because the thing you can say about them is they're resilient and they're resourceful, and that's what that was. And with us, the whole idea that we needed to reflect on our mistakes in Vietnam, I find that insulting and inaccurate, because I don't think those guys made bad mistakes. And the people who are making mistakes in Vietnam were the ones who decided, let's bring in 100,000 and put them in the Army and the Marine Corps. You know, in 1968, 69, and then send these guys out and ask a 22-year-old lieutenant and a 24-year-old sergeant to have to deal with that shit. And then at the same time, fight a determined, highly disciplined enemy. So I thought that the whole idea that, like, somehow we're better now because of this wonderful renaissance of thinking that was brought about by General Gray, I think that's fucking horseshit. You know, I think it's horseshit. And here's the proof that's in the pudding. We fight this war against the one guy who's dumb enough to actually come at us force on force. We beat him in 4 days of ground action. And then the next war is and what a surprise. The enemy doesn't want to fight us that way anymore. Who would? And now we do the counterinsurgency. And once again, the types of guy who decide 100,000 would be a good idea, they decide that we can do this whole thing with 120,000. They've been so wasteful in the past, the military, and so capricious in their estimates. And so what happens? We get, like I say, of the 4,000 some odd guys who died in Iraq, maybe 2,500 of them didn't need to. And, and the same bullshit in Afghanistan over and over and over again. A bunch of guys micromanaging from the top what you're going to do. Obama in 2009 changed the rules of engagement, sends the casualty figures through the roof. I mean, we didn't even have 300 dead or 400 dead by 2009. By 2012, we're up well over 1,000, almost to 1,500. And so that's what kind of pissed me off about the whole thing. The idea that somehow we're fucked up just trying to deal with the stupidity of the strategic leadership that we got. So take your maneuver warfare and go smoke a pipe with it.
Jimmy?
Yeah, the one sentence that popped out of me was it talked about that maneuver, the new warfighting theory had a broad utility but required significant judgment and application, which had been a source of frustration for some Marine readers looking for more specific guidance. And that was the issues that we were dealing with in Quantico, were the guys who said, hey, there's an FMFM that says this is the United tack, this is the way you do it, and here are all the steps, and I can break these things down and train up to this particular thing. It was a difference between guys who wanted to be given exactly how to do something as opposed to those of us who were reading more saying, no, there's an application for this specific night attack, maybe in Korea on the Hill battles in 1952, which is exactly where that damn night attack came from that we did at TBS. But minus, of course, the artillery prep continuous on top of the objective. But that was the objective. And so you're reading this article because it's interesting because we've talked about this over and over again and over the years, Mac. All of us have about that when we went through and were dealing with these things about initiative and trust tactics and whatnot. And Marine Corps did pretty well. I mean, I watched in Helmand, you guys came in, completely disrupted the Taliban in the south of Helmand, drove them out of the damn province. It was a masterful application of maneuver with some firepower, et cetera. But there's no discussion. How do you have this discussion with this new doctrine, whatever the hell it's going to be, with this distributed island hopping operations? Where's this level of discussion within the Corps? Because we were just smart aleck first lieutenant junior captains having our own meetings, kicking field grade officers out of the fucking things, deciding what the hell this all meant. You can't even do that now because nobody knows what these new tactics are going to be or what these new skills are going to require. So that's what's the most alarming about reading the article. It's kind of refreshing because, yep, we were there, but what the hell are you going to do now?
I have a question for Jeff. One of the things, and Tim's dad came on and, you know, lived one of these nightmarish examples. And then I've done a number of interviews on the Battle of Gitlin's Corner, which is another, which are guys, and that is the professional military education of the officer corps. I don't know, was it, you know, you went to AWS and that was it? We didn't tend to be readers, and you see some of the things that get done in Vietnam, and they're heartbreaking because guys are going to lose the only life they ever have because somebody won't tell Timmy's dad that, hey, we got an arc light going in, move your guys to make sure they're safe, and they won't say that, and they tell them all to come back to an LZ, and exactly what Major Lynch tells them is going to happens, and they medevac over 150, and the dead went last. And so which is the title, I think, of his Gazette article. And so, and then in Gitlin's Corner, it's, hey, a lot of NBA activity. We should probably, you know, lash up tonight as a company, not real comfortable with, you know, this. And then they say, hey, shut up and color, or we'll send somebody out there that will. Okay. And that OPSO and the battalion commander both get relieved when they send another company out there and they get hammered. And then a third company goes out after there, stays together as a company and knocks the shit out of the NVA. And so to me, I hear
that's
what
not a maneuver warfare thing. That's just, you know, that's a march of folly type thing. I mean, nobody, you know, there's people make fuck ups like that in every type of conflict.
No. So I'm just saying is a byproduct. So to me, the maneuver warfare thing, I don't know that the Marine Corps ever operated with a maneuver warfare philosophy. Yeah. We studied it, but guys, you know, had relative different understandings of it. Guys implemented it very different, you know. And when you can see everybody, you can see everybody in the organization, and then electronically, when you're watching your company's report in chat windows, and you're submitting con-ops for a squad to do an insert up to the MEF level, that to me is not so much maneuver warfare.
That, if that's the case, then we failed, that's for sure.
Yeah, and so to me, but I go back to the stories that and the things I've done in Vietnam. Now, maybe those exist in every war, and I've happened to seize on a couple, and I'm drawing too broad of an implication from it. Yeah. But I think one of the benefits of the maneuver warfare discussion was an increase in the reading program, an increase in writing, an increase in discourse, which I think has had other benefits.
Yeah,
you were reading anyway.
I wish it had not been called maneuver warfare, because I think that confuses the issue. in a lot of ways. And it's not a doctrine, right? It's a philosophy. The philosophy of warfare is about human will. Who's going to quit, or how do you make him quit? And then I think a lot of the concepts are really useful, you know, services and gaps, speed, concentration. Mm-hmm. And then how do you take tactical manuals and how do they fit into this philosophy? Because the tactical manual gives you a good way to execute a certain task, a good way to execute a certain task that may or may not apply in this moment. But if you think and understand that this is about will and to Jeff's point, it's too bad that President Bush and President Obama had never read FMFM1. Because they would have understood. It's about human will. And they did not have the will to win. They didn't have the will to define what winning would look like. It wasn't clear that Nixon knew what winning was. Winning was get the U.S. out of Vietnam. That was the strategic level to him. That was how he defined it. May not be good for us and how we looked at things. So when people equate maneuver warfare to force-on-force exercises and rapid mobility that confuses the enemy, that's, to me, that's not what it is at all. Right. It's a philosophy. And you know, when I went to TBS, I had read FMFM1 once and wasn't much impressed. And I ended up having to teach that introductory class. So I read that book every 2 months, and that original FMFM1 Warfighting was a phenomenally great book. It really expressed things in a timeless sort of way, in a very concise way, that I think helped me think about things for a long time and still does. Speed and concentration mean a lot. You know, people that think they can keep going forever at this sort of speed have a fundamental misunderstanding of how the world works. I thought all that was good. And I think if General Gray, the biggest thing General Gray brought back into the Marine Corps, I think, was this idea of thinking and education. And I don't know that we got it right, because I went to AWS a few years after that, and it was fucking brute rote stupidity. We still haven't really figured out how to do education.
The non-standard CAD.
Stuff is good.
I think that, you know, and it's interesting in the article they talk about the German influence of all, and all that. I mean, I think that whole discussion existed in the Marine Corps among a very, very small number of people. Right?
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? And it tended to be people that wrote, so, you know, it appeared on a relatively consistent basis. But I agree absolutely with Will in that I think that the thing that this whole discussion of maneuver warfare and General Gray, you know, I think to the extent that he made officers learn their craft, read and be broader, you know, then hopefully we reduce the numbers of LZ Margos that we've had in subsequent conflicts, because we're a bit more professional. We study our craft more, right? We're into it more, and I think that's the true. And as Will said, you know, I remember General Zinni in his PME that he did at the base school, and he says, you know, I got a little problem with this maneuver warfare stuff. It seems like we're telling people to move on people when you can shoot them. And he said, and he says, you know, firepower is nobody's handmaiden, Jack, right? He says something like, you give me six batteries TOT. He said, I'll take that shit anytime before I tell my companies to get up and let's go. He said, you know, fire maiden is good. Steel on target is good. And he said, so to me, and so when you hear that, it's like, okay, so it's not a set of rules in any situation. It's, you know, it's kind of a, it's kind of a way you think about war, as we'll talk about, speed and concentration, how long you can sustain these things, being critically aware. And to me, that's about becoming a professional. And I have this really shitty thing that I would say to human beings when they beg for it. And that is, and I don't roll it out as a trite statement, but when somebody wants to like get it on with me in public and they were stupid, I drop this on them in front of my friends who would always laugh at it. No, no, no. I get it. You're just fundamentally ignorant about your own profession. Now, when you say that in a group, that goes over pretty well with your friends. But it was true, and they'd be begging for it. And so I think what happened, I think to all of us, and this is what we still do today, we enjoy this intellectual discourse, if you can call it intellectual. We enjoy, you know, this exploration. We enjoy learning and seeing it in different ways. And I think that's General Gray's great gift. And if quote-unquote maneuver warfare had a lasting impact on the Marine Corps, I think it's certainly in the area of the fruits of a more professionally educated about their craft, you know, group of leaders in the organization.
Yeah, it made it part of the competition, that's for sure.
Yeah, reading. Yeah, reading. Like, reading was okay. Kind of like mental health. It's okay. Yeah. You can go. Timmy, thoughts? You've been quiet.
No. I was just following along with you guys, anticipating our next discussion, quite frankly.
Well, we're done, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Oh, I thought we were going to talk about that one article on the promotion.
We'll do that another time. All right, what are you reading? Will?
Yeah, I finished A Quiet Cadence, the book you interviewed Mark Trainer last week.
Yep.
You and I have talked a little bit about it offline. There's parts of it that are absolutely phenomenal. And I'll tell you, some of the dialogue of the characters in Vietnam will have you, you wish you were standing there in that group. You want to know those people and be part of them. But I highly recommend it. It gets a little blunt in the end as opposed to a novel, but it's still, I thought it was really well done. And right now I'm reading a book that Victor Davis Hanson wrote 2 years ago called The Case for Trump. And it's not a political sort of thing. It is, you know, a classicist discussion of how the president appealed to people during that election and how the opposition had sort of miscalculated where they stood amongst the electorate. And he weaves certain things from ancient Greece and Rome politicians in there. And it's really good, and it's absolutely infuriating as you read it.
And so, explain the infuriating piece.
Yeah. So when when you talk about, you know, sort of the deep state or the swamp, and I knew a bunch of this stuff, but he reminds you of all the people that were involved in the FBI investigations, the unmasking, the high levels of the previous administration, and how through family relationships or marriage are connected to so many people in the media at very high levels. And that the very basic, blunt things that they did, lying under oath to Senate panels, in the case of John Brennan, for example. It's absolutely infuriating to be reminded of all of those things. I mean, something as simple as Samantha Power, who was the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, requested 216 unmaskings and then denied that she had done that under oath.
Yeah.
And it's just left there as unresolved. So either someone forged her signature to allow surveillance of a U.S. citizen to expose their identity, i.e. complete violation of all of your rights, or she committed perjury. But you know what? We don't know right now. And so I typically don't read that political sort of current event political book, but because it was Victor Davis Hanson, I said, yeah, I'll read that. And it's his book. He's good. He's a great writer.
Did you get it on your Kindle, Will, or did you buy it?
No, I actually borrowed it from my father.
Oh.
I didn't say stole, Jeff. I actually borrowed it.
I don't know. I don't recognize such verbs when it comes to reading.
That's good. So the name of the book, Will? The case for Trump.
The Case for Trump. I think it was written in 18.
Right.
So it's been out a few years.
Right.
It's got that stuff about Samantha Powers. Yeah, at least by 18.
Right.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff, what are you reading?
Well, it would not surprise you guys to hear that I'm reading Timmy's book, Neptune's Inferno, that he recommended by the young Harsha Schwerger-Rager, whatever his name is. And also, at the same time, I'm reading the book by Gilbert that Will recommended about the Holocaust. And they're both great. And I go back and forth in between them. And I'm pissed off now because of it, because both of them piss you off. But not really, because they're both very well written, and it's great history. And but when I get depressed reading the Holocaust one, I go to the Neptune's Inferno. But
and then what happens when you read Neptune's Inferno after you read the Holocaust? Now I'm not only depressed, I'm pissed too.
Well, it makes me hopeful reading that.
Okay.
Because it's full of interesting shit about Admiral King, Admiral Nimitz, you know, all those guys, you know, who worked that time frame, and how desperate it was at Guadalcanal, and how much the Marine Corps, and I'm certainly one of these, especially when I was a young Marine, who said, yeah, the Navy jumped us at Guadalcanal, those fucking squids. But the truth is, they saved our ass at Guadalcanal. They got defeated, and then they came back, you know, and it was very touch and go. And then the stuff at the Holocaust, I always had a kind of a morbid curiosity about, you know, you read about massacres in history, massacres of ethnic groups and people of religious minorities and stuff, like, you know, the Turkish massacre, the Armenians comes to mind, and other things, the repeated massacre of Jews throughout history. And there never was where you had this irrational motivation of murder mixed in with coldly practical, you know, execution of it, where people are actually calculating the amount of resources and stuff in order to get it done. And you see, it's just appalling. I don't think it's just a German thing either, although they're the first ones who got caught at it, you know, really. But the idea that Himmler is watching one of these special action things where they massacre people by firing squad, and he says, you know, he's not an idiot, but he's totally – you know, he's totally insensitive, because he says, you know, I'm sensitive to the fact that this is going to have this is going to be hard on our young people who are shooting these Jews. So we need to come up with a more humane way to kill them, because it's rough on the people who are actually doing it. Hence the gas chamber and all that other stuff, you know. And so it's just an interesting thing. But I'd say after a while it gets depressing. Like right now I'm in the part about the beginning, like when they first managed to achieve power, where they first got, you know, where Hitler becomes the chancellor in 1933. And then as the snowballing effect of all these anti-Jewish laws and how legal everything was in the beginning. I think I'm basically parroting Will from like a couple months ago now, or a month and a half ago. But that's another thing it's instructive to read it, because it makes you think, you know, these fucking lawyers could pull this shit off anywhere. So that's what I'm doing now. That's what I'm reading now.
All right. Timmy, what are you reading?
I'm reading Losing Small Wars, about the British Army in Afghanistan and Iraq, specifically for a term paper I have to do, which will be on counterinsurgency in the Helmand Province and the absolute futility of NATO and the UN. It will be very popular, I'm sure. Yeah, but I mean, I'm just reading this thing. It's very interesting. Hey, but I've got to say that that Tom Wade, who's a Navy guy that listens to us every week, was telling me you've got to read Ian Toll, too, when I was going on and on about our Garrick Hornfisher. And so that guy, too, he graduated college in like 1989. He's got a trilogy out about the Pacific War. I think Will started reading one of them. I've got to get on that next and see it and compare the two of them. It's just weird that two guys much younger than us, a generation behind us, write about the Pacific Fleet in World War II in such depth. That's just weird to me.
When I was looking for it on my Kindle search, that name Toll was right there with, Hornfisher, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. They got to know each other, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm not reading anything. I'm contemplating reading things. But no, I'm making movies, so I don't have time right now. But
wow.
Yeah.
You sound like a millennial.
Short attention span.
Don't beg for me to tell you guys to fuck off, okay? Just say, Mac, tell us to fuck off. We want that, and I'll. You don't have to beg for it. And just say crazy shit.
I'd rather imagine what the title. The bad lieutenant colonel. Let me see. That's a good.
No, one. Not the bad. Fundamentally ignorant about your own craft. How not to be fundamentally ignorant about your own craft. You let me tell you, the joy of dropping that on some asshole that's arguing stupid shit to me was, especially in front of my friends, right? Because they, not that they knew it was coming, but they sensed that the end was near. But I enjoyed that anyway. All right, boys. First of all, interesting discussion today. Interesting discussion. China. So, yay or nay? Do we see military conflict with China in the next 30 years? United States broad military conflict with China. Yay or nay? Will?
No.
Tim?
I think they got a lot of extra dudes, and that makes me nervous. What do you do in a society that has that kind of disparity between males and females? Because it can't be healthy. So that's the one wild card that gives me pause for concern.
Yay or nay?
I say yay. I think we are. We're that stupid.
Jeff?
We're dumb enough to do it.
You say within the next 30 years?
Yes.
Yeah, yay. Is there anybody we haven't fought in the last 30 years? I mean, so 30 years from now, we'll get everybody we missed, I think, and they're one of them.
In 30 years, we've, what, Iraq and then Afghanistan. That's all we fought.
Iraq, Afghanistan. We shot people in Africa. We shot people in Somalia.
That's just white noise. Fight, like real fight. A real fight. I don't see it happening because I think they have too much to lose. And I understand Tim's concern, but I see them as having too much. They're not Russia. I see them as having too much to lose. So anyway. All right, boys. Well, first of all, I appreciate your time today. And as always, keep up the great work. And Jeff, anything new to report? What are you doing? Tim's going to school. Will's – well, we need a I was asked specifically before we end to get a poker update from Will. But Jeff, how's your frustrated, bitter life going?
Well, I got a distraction. I'm trying to help my stepson with the VA, and so it's actually going pretty good now. But the thing about the VA is, I have these grand plans of things I'm gonna leverage people to do. It never works out the way I intend, but yet there's benefits to it, if you know what I mean. So it's difficult. You know, it's a medication thing, but it's also the whole way of trying to get the VA. To, number one, talk to each other. I'm trying to get a connectivity to encourage it between the VA here. He's here with us right now to back to Pittsburgh. And for one out of every eight VA people is a concerned professional, and the other ones are not. And so it's difficult. It's like being an advisor when I had to deal with the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army. They both hated each other. To the point where they're irrational, and it caused more of them to get killed by the Muj. So it's like kind of like that. I'm dealing with a lot of wackos. When the most sane person dealing with something, the most sane and caring person dealing with something is Jeff Kenny. You got troubles in River City.
You got You know what? That is absolutely well said. And even more importantly, it's true. Will,
and I am fundamentally ignorant of this profession.
Let me tell you. And when you get to rubbing the rocks on that one with fundamental ignorance and then people that don't know what they're doing, you're going to get a good explosion at some point. So we just could all keep our fingers crossed that we could be around when it happens to see it. Like, holy
Jeff's
shit.
Jeff's not in this podcast because he's in the penitentiary right now.
They don't allow Skype at this time of the day. What about, so Will, give us a poker update. How's the...
I'll tell you something. So the casinos here, there's only one that's open now. And they've gone from tables of five to tables of six.
Oh.
So that's okay, but it's not great. But the underground scene in Kansas City is absolutely booming. So,
Are you an underground poker player?
Yeah. I mean, I got forced into it. Although to say that we play with more than chips, right, and that we gamble for real money would be illegal. Which, in Kansas.
Of course you wouldn't do that.
No, but the underground scene is booming because a casino is such a farce.
You sound like a beatnik. The underground scene is booming, babe.
No, Will is the Johnny Lazio of today's Kansas City.
Yeah, you know who he was, think right, about Will? This, though. Think about this. So when you go into the casino, you got to wear a mask, sanitize your hands, maintain social distance. Then you sit down at a poker table where you're no more than 24 inches away from someone else. I mean, again, it just continues to prove that this mass thing, it's a complete placebo. And we also know that you're completely immune from COVID. You don't need to wear a mask as long as you're in a closed salon in San Francisco getting a blow dry.
Well, even worse is when you're tricked into something like that. I mean,
it did remind me of Marion Barry. You know, the bitch set me up.
You're right. She plagiarized that from what the fuck was his name?
Marion Barry.
Yeah, Marion Barry. Yeah. That's outstanding. Will.
That also went on in the midst of this maneuver warfare discussion. We were having to deal with Marion Barry was the mayor of Washington, D.C., cavorting around the city, doing all kinds of crazy shit. And so that was a part of.
He used to steal the toys for Tots.
That night, that night, me and Kerry were actually watching the news. When they showed that video of that.
You know, we used to have these discussions. Instead of like doing it like this, we would be out getting ready to do a problem. And, you know, there's like 20 captains sitting around like on these logs, everybody with their knife out talking shit, or those people that are coffee drinkers. And I have a memory of that I've never forgotten. We were talking about some terrible domestic violence incident in D.C. And do you remember Jeff Weiss? Nickname was Snuffy. And he's Jeff's a quiet guy, good guy, smart guy. And he's sitting there, and there's all of us like assholes hanging out, and we're talking about it. Somebody makes a comment that, like, yeah, you know, the people that are abused themselves are like 80% or give some percentage about being abusers themselves. And right. Jeff didn't say shit, right? And he's sitting there and he says, that's bullshit. And everybody stops. It's like that when E.F. Hutton talks commercial. Everybody stops and like, what? It's like when in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, when the Indian talks. Everybody's like, what? And he says, look, he said, I got the shit beat out of me as a little kid. He said, I couldn't do that to my own kid. He said, and so people say that stuff. He said, my wife gets pissed at me because she has to be the disciplinarian because I can't do it. And I don't. So if you were abused, how you get to the point where you do that to somebody else? He said, I don't get it. And I don't think that's true. And I've never, ever, ever forgotten that. And those are the kind of discussions we would be having that all of a sudden would spin into something very serious and very cool because you had those kind of guys sitting around. That's all right, boys. Thanks for the visit.
All right, Mac. Take care, buddy.
Yep.
Sure. See you.
There you have it. The Mensa brothers here on a on a Thursday edition of Auburn Radio. So Tom Seaver passed away, former Marine, and I knew him a little bit for a few years of my life when he pitched for my dad both in Cincinnati and then in Boston. So I tell some funny Tom Seaver stories. Somebody sent me a text message. Mac, those Tom Seaver stories are hilarious. And I just have to tell you this. He's a rare combination of an athlete that had intellect. I mean, would be sitting in his locker, right? And he'd be doing, you know, the New York Times crossword. And you'd see the Wall Street Journal stuck in his, you know, wall locker when nobody did that, okay? But he was funny, and he was just he's one of the great pitchers of baseball history. But he was a Marine, and I tell a few stories. One is him introducing my father and me to his parents. And this guy was as big as you could be in terms of a Madison Avenue athlete. And the respect he showed to his mom and dad, the way he introduced my dad and I to his mom and dad, were just like you would want your son or daughter to do if you raised them right. And I never forgot that about him. Funny stuff, lighting people's shoes on fire on days they were supposed to travel. So they had to wear a pair of platform shoes through an airport and stuff. But what a great guy he was. And again, really proud that when I found out that he was a Marine, that there guys like that would have that in their character. And I played a little audio of him being interviewed saying, you know, respect, self-discipline, hard work. You know, I learned a lot of that stuff, not in baseball. I learned it in the Marine Corps. And he also says something else in it. He says, respecting the uniform that you wear. And you'll see pictures of Tom Seaver, and he wears his baseball hat like a Marine Corps cover. So if you look at pictures of him on days he's not pitching, when he's standing around, you'll see a fair number where that cover is cocked down over his eyes or just tilted over his eyes, and that's where it comes from. So anyway, talk about him. And then with the Mensa brothers, we talk about two things, and one is much been written this week about China. After a Pentagon report, DOD report comes out about where China is relative to its development as a military superpower. So let's talk about that a little bit. About a 15-page article I'll include in the post. And then there's a series of articles, and Chris Woodbridge mentioned them yesterday when I talked to him. But Woody mentioned a series called Marine Corps Maneuver Warfare, Historical Context. So, anyway, we talk about that as well. On a Thursday, All Marine Radio here. Thanks for listening. Don't touch that dial. More of it coming up next. Have a great day on a Thursday. I am out. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life, by the way. It's always a good thing to do. We'll be back in-